You can now download a free PDF copy or a beautiful printed copy of issue number 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Our topic today is Maurice Nicole and the psychology of the fourth way teachings of Gurdjieff and Uspensky. My guest is Gary Lachman, who is one of the world's foremost historians of esoteric culture. Additionally, he is formerly a songwriter and bass guitarist for the rock band Blondie. He's been interviewed a dozen times previously on New Thinking Aloud on topics including Rudolf Steiner, Madame Blavatsky, Emanuel Swedenborg, P.D. Uspensky, Colin Wilson, Aleister Crowley, Hermeticism, Carl Jung, Chaos, Magic, and Russian Mysticism. His newest book is Maurice Nicole, Forgotten Teacher of the Fourth Way. Gary lives in England. And now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Gary. It's a pleasure to be with you once again.
Oh, same here, Jeffrey. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
I note that this is our 15th interview. We've covered a lot of ground in the previous 14 going over esoteric culture, and I think today will be a deep dive into the teachings of Gurdjieff and Uspensky and the whole movement that surrounds the what are known as the fourth way teachings. And I guess a good starting point would be to define what is meant by the fourth way.
Well, the fourth way is a name that Gurdjieff told Uspensky could be used for the system that he was being taught. And the idea was that there's three traditional ways, and it's ways of spiritual development. It's ways of, you know, developing your inner world and your spiritual life. And one way is the way of the fakir, which is the physical, it's the body. So the fellow who lies on beds of nails, or, you know, stands in one position for ages, or somebody today who would spend an inordinate amount of time at the gym, maybe, or in yoga class. In some asana, they're developing their body, developing the physical way of transcending, you know, their everyday consciousness. And then you have the way of the monk, which is the emotional way, the way of reverence and love towards, some divine figure, some deity. I mentioned in the book Ramakrishna, who would go into a faint of ecstasy just at the very mention of the name of Kali, you know, the great mother goddess, and he was a devotee. So that's the development of the emotions. And then there's the way of the yogi, which is dhyana, the way of concentration of the mind, controlling the thoughts and focusing, you know, your attention and concentration on a single item, so on and so on. But each of those things, even though each one of them can get you some way along the way towards spiritual development, they have their drawbacks as well. So while the fakir is able to control his body, he's not doing that well with his emotions or his mind. And the monk who is able to, trigger this great emotional kind of ecstasy has very little control over the body and, is usually not, a very good thinker. And then the one who can control the mind, and this is, an endemic problem, occupational hazard with intellectuals, they have no idea what to do with their body and are completely at a loss of their emotions. So each of those ways, even though they have some advantages, they have disadvantages. But Gurdjieff said his way, the system that in the early 19-teens or the mid-19-teens in Russia, he was teaching Uspensky, was a way in which you worked at each one of those things at the same time, simultaneously. So you worked at the body, the mind, and the emotions at the same time. And just parenthetically, you can see even earlier than that, in Dostoevsky's great novel, The Brothers Karamazov, you have the three brothers. And one of them is the emotional brother, one of them is the physical brother, and one of them is the mental. So, I mean, that whole idea of this kind of triad of different ways or different types, something that predates Gurdjieff and all that. I mean, you can find it in Plato. But the idea in the fourth way was this: you could work on all of those together. And the other additional advantage of the fourth way is that you didn't have to go to a monastery or an ashram or a zendo to do it. You do it in your everyday life. And Gurdjieff told Uspensky, the very conditions you find yourself in, those you want to escape, are the best ones for you to work within.
You point out an interesting paradox in your book that according to the philosophy of the fourth way, the problems to be worked through are the natural ones that occur in the normal course of a normal human lifetime. You don't need any ashram. You don't need anything special. But then when one looks at the various fourth way groups, it seems as if the fourth way teachers were creating all sorts of special, unnatural conditions for their students.
Yeah, there's something I sort of jokingly refer to as institute-itis that they have. And it comes from Gurdjieff, you know, famously in the early 1920s, he set up in France, in Fontainebleau, outside of Paris, his Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man. And this was in this old chateau, which was run down. And basically, Uspensky was already in London, and this is how Maurice Nicole, who I've written the book about, finds out about all this stuff, because he goes to one of Uspensky's lectures. And then when word comes around that Gurdjieff's in France with this institute, all these people go across the channel. Nicole goes, Orage goes, many, many others go to spend time at the institute. And the whole idea there is that you sped up. You increased and sped up what you would normally encounter in life, which is confusion, you know, and problems and inconvenience. But Gurdjieff was a master at creating artificial inconvenience or artificial chaos. So one of the things they did is he would put people together that he knew would not get along. You know, they their temperaments were, you know, different, so they would grate on each other. Or he would forbid you to smoke, or he would forbid you to read, or he would do something in which you were pulled out of your ordinary conditions in which to sort of face yourself. But then you went back. The whole idea was you went through, it was kind of like boot camp or commando training. You went through this and then you went back into life, because the whole idea was if you only were awake, which is what the whole idea was about, to wake up. If you're only awake in the context of, you know, the special conditions, then it didn't work. You know, you should be able to maintain that state of alertness and wakefulness in everyday life.
Well, we should also let our viewers and listeners know that this is a special interest to you, because you spent a period of years involved in the fourth way teachings, particularly the lineage associated with Uspensky. So you have both a lot of experience, and I suppose it's fair to say a certain attachment to this material.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, this is, I first became interested in Gurdjieff and Uspensky and the fourth way and all that many, many, many years ago. I mean, longer ago than I care to admit, when I was first reading about all this sort of stuff. And then in the early 1980s, first in New York and then in Los Angeles, from about 1981 to about 1985, I was involved in the actual, you know, what they called the work. This is sort of the homely term for the practical approach. I mean, the fourth way is sort of the esoteric term, but the work, because a lot of it is practical, it's physical. It's actually you have to go through this. It's not just sitting and I don't mean to, you know, diminish that, but it isn't just sitting and meditating. You actually go through a whole kind of psychodrama and very rough and tumble, you know, friction-inducing, you know, circumstances. But I did this in New York and in Los Angeles, and I learned a lot from it. But after a time, I just felt that in the end, it wasn't for me. And I think that's mostly says something about me than it, because I'm a bit more eclectic and I'm interested in lots of different things. So I tend to synthesize different things. And the people I was involved with, who were the actual Gurdjieff Foundation, the lineage down from Gurdjieff himself, he died in 1949. Mm-hmm. And then in the early 50s, the Gurdjieff Foundation was established in New York and then in Los Angeles. And Jean de Salzman, who was one of Gurdjieff's closest students, she was still alive. I think she died in 1990. She was the one who was carrying on sort of the real McCoy, as it were. So I did a lot of the hands-on sorts of things, yes, certainly got results and all that. But at the time, I just felt I was young and I wanted to do lots of other things. So I thought it was better rather than, stick with it when I was interested in other stuff rather than, they want to keep it pure and all that sort of thing. But I still think, the fundamental ideas with Gurdjieff and Uspensky is that, Gurdjieff told Uspensky that we're all asleep. Or we're all machines, we're mechanical. We believe we have free will. We believe we're conscious, but we're not really. But I know a way in which, we can become awake and conscious. And Uspensky had already written this remarkable book called Tertium Organum, the Third Organ of Thought, which was a surprise metaphysical bestseller in the early 1920s. So he was well on his way towards, exploring these other realms of consciousness. And he was a well-known figure in the theosophical circles in St. Petersburg and Moscow. And that's precisely because Gurdjieff sought him out, because he needed a good front man. Just like Madame Blavatsky sought out Colonel Olcott, because she was a wild card, but she needed a good front man. Likewise with Gurdjieff, and Uspensky was well-known, and he was brought into the fold. And then when he wound up in London in the early 20s, he wasn't lecturing about his ideas from his book, Tertium Organum. He was lecturing the system that he had learned from Gurdjieff. He spent from about 1914, I think, until about 1919, when they finally found themselves down in Constantinople. I mean, their whole time together is an adventure story itself, Uspensky's book In Search of the Miraculous. Because it's the backdrop is, the First World War, then the Russian Revolution, then the Russian Civil War, and an exploding Russia, collapsing Russia, and the Bolsheviks coming to power, and Gurdjieff and Uspensky and their followers being, funneled across the country down into, white Russian refugee camps in Constantinople.
My best guess is that maybe half of our audience will know nothing about the Fourth Way, will not have heard about Gurdjieff or Uspensky. And so a lot of what we're talking about, for example, you mentioned the name Oraj in passing, people will have no idea what we're talking about. And the other half of the audience may be people such as yourself who have had extensive experience with the Fourth Way and are very advanced in their understanding. So we're going to have to try and balance both of those. But I think it's fair to say the movement grew. It became quite large. I know I was exposed to it in the 1960s in Madison, Wisconsin, of all places. So I have to assume that by that time, by the 1960s, there must have been hundreds, if not even thousands, of little outposts of Fourth Way teachers.
Oh yeah, I mean Gurdjieff, Uspensky died in 1947. Gurdjieff died in 1949, but 1949 was the year when the book In Search of the Miraculous, which is Uspensky's account of the years he spent with Gurdjieff learning the system and against the backdrop of, a collapsing Russia. And then Gurdjieff's gargantuan jawbreaker of a very eccentric masterpiece, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which is, one of those what they call a doorstopper here in the UK. It's this gigantic text and in which it's difficult to say things, briefly, because there's so much history around it. But at a certain point, Gurdjieff stopped the Institute and he devoted himself to writing. And he wrote this, depends from your point of view, this unreadable, crazy book or this esoteric masterpiece, which you have to dig under to get the true meaning of. But this was a different direction he went into than what he had taught Uspensky. And then there's a split between the two. But those are the two main books. And then they came out around the same time. And then you have the Gurdjieff Foundation, which starts in the 1950s. And they carry on the teaching, but they always kept a low profile. I mean, they never really advertised this thing. It's one of the things that different than some other esoteric groups or, you know, spiritual groups or whatever. They don't go out of their way seeking, you know, members. They're actually, you've got to find your way to them. But then by the 60s, people like Timothy Leary, who, you know, he became very interested with the Gurdjieff work. And he, you know, talked about certain ideas that Gurdjieff had in the Psychedelic Review, that magazine he put out at the time. And so there was this sort of vogue. I mean, I first came across him, any mention of this was when I read Colin Wilson's book, The Occult, in 1975, when I was playing in a punk rock band in New York, so of all places. So, you know, it wasn't some emissary from an esoteric society that met me. You know, no, I just was reading some beat up paperback. But it was like, wow, this is fantastic stuff. And so, yes, there was. And my first encounter with it was before I joined the real thing, I went to a lecture about it in the Barbizon Hotel Midtown or the Upper East Side in New York. And so there were different groups there was a period, I would say, late 70s and the early 80s when there was a certain vogue about it. But then later on, people like Marion Williamson sort of took hold of, there's a symbol called the Enneagram. It's a nine-pointed symbol that Gurdjieff introduced to Uspensky. But then it's since become kind of common currency in a lot of New Age, you know, kind of circles. So a lot of these ideas have seeped in, and they're not necessarily, how should we say it, the roots of them aren't known. But it's never been quite as popular, I would say, as some other, like Jung or something like that. It's not as well known as Jung or someone.
They did attract a number of famous people. You write about Catherine Mansfield, for example, and you've mentioned Orage, who was a well-known literary figure in England. In fact, as you point out, they sought upper-class students in England and in France. It became sort of an elite preoccupation, I suppose, for people who had the time.
Yeah, sure, or the money. I mean, you know, you had to pay a certain amount to go to the institute in Fontainebleau. And the fellow written the book about Maurice Nicol, I mean, he was a prestigious Harley Street physician psychiatrist. And if you live in London, you know what Harley Street means. It's the street where, you know, the most prestigious upmarket doctors and psychologists and dentists, whatever, you know, have their establishment. So, and he had that. And he actually, you're right, because, I mean, A.R. Orage was the editor of a journal here called The New Age, you know, before our New Age was going. And this Mansfield with H.G. Wells and Bernard Shaw and all these other people at the time, there was this whole melange of different ideas bubbling away just before World War One. And it in theosophy and Fabian socialism and evolutionism and all this kind of stuff bubbled away in this kind of very optimistic atmosphere. Then World War One happened, and that all went out the window. So Orage was publishing all this interesting stuff, and he went to Uspensky's lectures, and he was captivated. And then Nicol, he went to one of them, and he was already Jung's lieutenant, British lieutenant. He was very close to C.G. Jung, in the same way that Freud saw Jung as inheriting, you know, the throne, inheriting, you know, the dynasty of psychoanalysis. Jung saw Maurice Nicol inheriting at least the British, you know, branch of it. And what happened is that Nicol went to one of Uspensky's lectures, and he basically, you know, changed his allegiance. And he, after a while, he wrote a Dear Carl letter, basically saying, I've changed over to Uspensky. But they were very, very close. I mean, Jung was the godfather of Nicol's child. And before the breakup, Jung used to come and stay with Nicol in his, you know, home in a very fashionable part of London. And there's a famous story of Jung having an encounter with a ghost in a cottage that Nicol rented outside of London, on the coast somewhere. And he got it at a very low price. And one of the reasons was that he was told it was haunted. And so one weekend, I think Jung, you know, he spent it by himself there or something. He was, because Jung was an Anglophile. He loved England. He loved coming to London a lot. And he said he woke up in the middle of the night and he saw half a woman's face on the pillow next to him. And there was all this really nauseating smell and all this horrible stuff. And he was so, you know, spooked that he went downstairs and he spent the rest of the night in an armchair with the candle lit. And this is the same Jung who had the 12 dead, you know, come to him in Kusnacht, you know, during the period he was writing the Red Book. So he had an encounter with the real, I was going to say a real life, you know, British ghost, and it really spooked him. So Nickel was a very, you know, he was clued in, as we say. He was networking with lots of interesting people, and then he went to see, you know, Uspensky, and then he was totally sold. And then when he heard that Gurdjieff, you know, had opened up the institute in France, he sold this prestigious, you know, practice that he had on Harley Street, and took his young wife, their young child, his sister-in-law, and the nanny, and they went, and we went to this place, and they really had no idea what they were heading into.
So you have this esoteric burgeoning. You have the fourth way movement. You have anthroposophy. You have theosophy. You've written about Aleister Crowley and the Golden Dawn. There's this esoteric burgeoning in Western culture, and at the same time, this enormous, very culturally powerful movement of depth psychology emerging. And Nicole is an important person in this history because he, as I see it, fuses these two traditions.
Yeah, this is true. Well, I mean, what you're saying, this is what I always call this period, the 1920s, as the golden age of Western esotericism, because you have everybody, it's like all the good bands are around at the same time playing. It's like you said, you have Crowley, Jung is starting out with the psychology club in Zurich, and he's gone through, you know, the whole Red Book experience, and he's done all that. And you've got, as you say, Crowley in Sicily with his Abbe of Thelema. You've got Gurdjieff in Fontainebleau. Uspensky has his own groups in London, and so on and so on. So it's just most of what we still, you know, today look at as kind of the Western esoteric tradition, at least this modern version, comes out of that time. And yeah, theosophy was still going strong, Krishnamurti, and so on and so on. Nicole, he always had a very strong spiritual appetite, and he always had a kind of interest in, you know, what we would call, I guess, sort of mythic religions and things of that sort. And so he was interested in the Gnostics. He was interested in the Hermeticists, and so on, and Meister Eckhart and Western mystics, and so on. At the same time that he was, you know, studying psychology. And I have to say, he himself, along with all the other stuff, he was a best-selling author under a pseudonym. He wrote under the pseudonym Martin Swain. And he wrote a book with his sister called Lord Richard in the Pantry, which is, if you know it, it's sort of like the old 1930s screwball film, My Man Godfrey, where you have someone who's an aristocrat pretends to be, you know, the butler or the cook or something. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of irony. So he wrote a story like that. It was a novel, and it was a best-selling novel. It was made into a theater production, and they were earning like thousands of pounds a month from royalties. And then it was made into a film. The film is lost, but it's one of the films. It's actually on the BFI, the British Film Institute's, you know, register of, you know, lost films. So he was, you know, a successful character, and his father was a very, very famous political figure. So yes, Gurdjieff drew, you know, from the creme de la creme, but he gave all that up to go and spend 6 months. It's unclear exactly, 6 months or a year, whatever, somewhere in between that, at the Prairie. And what he had to do, he was called the kitchen boy. And what this meant was that he had to get up at about 5 a.m, light all the fires for the stoves to feed like 60 people. And then later, after breakfast, he had to wash all the dishes, but Gurdjieff didn't allow using soap. So it was all these kind of inconvenience. He had to wash all the dishes, but cold water. And that's, so this is a fellow, when he was growing up, his father was friends with Winston Churchill and Lord Asquith and other, you know, very famous people at the time. And he was sitting in on conversations with them. And then now he's here in this mad kind of work camp, you know, and his wife is like cleaning the toilets and the sister-in-law is doing something else. I mean, the nanny had the best of it. All she had to do was take care of the kid. But everybody else is doing this, you know, all this hard physical labor all the time and eating very little. Gurdjieff would introduce these very, very, should we say, drastic kind of measures. There was something called the stop exercise. So whatever you were doing, he would say, stop. And you had to stay in exactly that position And there's one story of somebody who took a drag cigarette and had to hold it in as much as he can until Gurdjieff said, "Let go," or you're holding a hot cup of tea, you know, and it's burning your hand. So this was all geared to upset our usual mechanical habitual ways.
If I recall correctly, you wrote that the 2 years that Nicole spent there at Fontainebleau with Gurdjieff were the best years of his life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he himself later became a teacher of this. After he was there, he went back to London. And he became part of the Uspensky kind of strain of it. There was the Gurdjieff strain. They'd split apart, teaching the same ideas, but in very different ways. And he became part of that. And he was a student of Uspensky's for about, I don't know, from he returned, say, 1924 to London, and then from then until about 1931, he was a student. And in 31, Uspensky said, "Now it's time for you to go and teach the system." And he and his wife taught it for the next 20 years. He died in the early 1950s. But he wanted to, you talked about earlier, this institutitis, where even though sort of the doctrine is, you know, you don't have to go to a monastery to do this work, you can do it in the conditions you find yourself in. Like so many others, they wanted to set up some place where, you know, they could create the special conditions and all that too. So they kind of, he was emulating Gurdjieff and wanted to sort of do what Gurdjieff did. And understandably, you know, it must have been an intense time, because everyone was like, Gurdjieff was this mad Levantine sort of, you know, taskmaster. You don't know whether he's devil or God or something like that. And he's got the mustachio, and it's like, you know, it must have been an incredibly, how should we say it, transformative time, whatever way. Some people loved it. Some people ran away from it. Some people actually, you know, physically, traumatized by it, and so on and so on. So, but for Nicole, it probably was the most meaningful time in his life. And then he tried to recreate it at different places. And so one of the things that he does, and actually in a larger context, he's early on doing this kind of off the grid sort of thing that people, you know, do today. He made these sort of small communities outside of London. He'd get a house. And initially, when they first had, was one that they had to put together and all that, and they actually built a house. So he was doing the same sorts of things, the same kind of quick, hurry, 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 put it up really quick, you know, quick and dirty, get it done really fast, kind of thing. They did that. And then in different places. I mean, one time when World War II started, some place they had was requisitioned by the army, so they had to give it up and all that kind of thing. So one of the things he does, and this is why I talk about this institutitis, is he himself tends to want to set up these kind of communities and sort of, you know, stay within it and that kind of thing. And I think there's a religious side to it too, because he was a very religious character. And the aspect of the Gurdjieff system that attracted him was something that Gurdjieff called esoteric Christianity, which was the kind of the secret side of Christianity. I mean, Gurdjieff said lots of things. Half of the time you don't know quite, was he just saying that for the effect? Does he really mean this or not? That kind of thing. But Nicol had a deep love of Christianity, but not the Christianity he was brought up in, this Presbyterianism, which was, you know, very dour and dire, and all it made him think of was sin. So he was trying to find some kind of church, some kind of congregation he could belong to. And I think that's one of the things he was trying to recreate in these communities.
Well, there is a lot of paradoxes in my mind associated with the fourth way. For example, as you write, Uspensky seemed to renounce the whole system at the end of his life. And yet here we are today, some more than 70 years since the death of Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and the fourth way teachings seem to be thriving. So one gets the impression that something is working.
Well, I mean, they're powerful ideas. And I mean, sadly, Uspensky, I mean, we talked about this a while ago, because we had a chat over the book.
And as a matter of fact, let me link to it, Gary, for our viewers who haven't watched your earlier interview about Uspensky, for people who are able to catch that link in the upper right-hand corner of their screen, you can link to it directly.
Yeah, I mean, Uspensky was a brilliant, you know, thinker and writer, and actually he was a rather gentle, poetic soul initially. He sort of came to his own in these sort of artistic bohemian circles in St. Petersburg and Moscow in the early 20th century. And he wrote short stories and he wrote poetry. And if you know his book, New Model of the Universe, which is a fantastic collection of different essays about different esoteric sorts of things, but he has these sort of pen portraits of the tarot cards or his travels in search of the miraculous, the Sphinx and the Taj Mahal and places like that. And they're very poetic. But then he went through the Gurdjieffian mill, and Gurdjieff was a kind of, if you know Zorba the Greek, if you know that sort of story, you know, Zorba is this man's man, and then, you know, the intellectual meets him, Kazantzaki's intellectual, and he's kind of timid and all that, and Zorba teaches him how to live, and, you know, stop living in your head and all that kind of thing. So I think there was a similar sort of, you know, alchemy, let's put it, between Gurdjieff and Uspensky, but I think in the end, he denied that part of himself later on in life, that creative sort of side. He devoted himself completely to teaching the system. And sadly, towards the last days of his life, and he left London when the Blitz started. He didn't want to, you know, he already lived through the collapse of Russia. He thought the Nazis were going to win anyway, so he came to the States. And then he sadly sank into reminiscing at night about the old days in Russia and getting through a bottle or two or three, you know, with J.G. Bennett or, you know, some of the other students at the time. And he more or less kind of sank into a kind of alcoholism. And you know, so this was the sort of sad side of it. And in the end, he didn't want In Search of Miraculous to be published. Talk about a shock. I mean, a shock is a technical term in the system. This is what Gurdjieff would do, like that stop kind of thing. He would create some kind of shock that would, you know, take you out of your normal everyday habitual behavior. But Uspensky outshocked the master because he came back to London, 47, and he gave a series of lectures at a place called Cullet House here over in Barons Court, where the Study Society, which is a Uspensky group, still carries on today, where he basically said that it didn't work. He renounced the system. He rejected it. His students didn't know, well, they weren't his students anymore, and they didn't know what to make of this. Some people thought, oh, this is some fantastic, you know, work, psycho, you know, drama thing. He's not really meaning that, you know, is a test for us, all that kind of thing. And then the other story is that he was driven around all these different places that he knew in London or in England during the time he lived here, and would sit like for long periods of time, just looking at these places that he knew. And the whole idea was that he wanted to fix them in his memory, because his E-Day fix, the idea that more than any other was pure Uspensky, was this notion of what he called the eternal recurrence. And if you know the film Groundhog Day, it's the same day over and over. Well, eternal recurrence is, it's your same life over and over. You reincarnate into exactly the same life over and over. Nietzsche said this as well, over and over and over again. Uspensky believed if you woke up, if you got out of your habitual, you know, state of consciousness, you'd be able to remember your recurrences and you could get off the wheel. And what he was doing in his last days when he was being driven to all these places was having these scenes imprinted on his memory, so the next time around, he would remember. And there's some suspicion that one of the things he wanted to change was his meeting with Gurdjieff. There's some suspicion that he might have, like, maybe next time, maybe we'll do things a bit differently. So.
One of the fascinating things that you write about is that early on, Uspensky declared that Gurdjieff had gone insane.
Yeah, there's all this. Well, I said this is all this psychodrama. There's a couple things for that. One thing was there's this automobile accident that Gurdjieff has. He was an abominable driver. Everyone was terrified to get in the car with him, but it was a special thing to get in the car with him, because if you survived, you did pretty good. But, you know, he just, and one day, he and his secretary, they usually travel together, because Gurdjieff would drive into Paris, Fontainebleau. And he was the other side of him. He was this incredible entrepreneur. He had like restaurants going on and other businesses and things like that. So he was incredible survivor or incredible kind of street smart. So he was able to turn a dollar like all the time in amazing sorts of ways. But on this one day before he was going into Paris, he made special, you know, attention that the car, everything in the car would be checked, the brakes, everything, the steering, everything would be checked. And then he told the secretary, no, you, when we return from Paris, you take the train. I want to drive alone, which was strange. And then what happens is he's driving his Citroën, and on the road between Paris and Fontainebleau, goes off the road and it crashes into a tree. And when he's found, he's lying out on the road with a cushion from the car under his head, and like in like someone had put him there, or that somehow he had. But he's complete. You know, he's like he's his hands are lacerated. He's very very horrible wounds, and he's really hurt very badly, and he was unconscious for several days after that and all that. But the idea is that he somehow arranged the accident on purpose. That he somehow made it happen on purpose because he sort of wanted to get rid of everybody around him. He got what he could from all the people around him. He always said, I need rats for my experiments. And so he would collect lots of people around him and then maybe whatever, learn from his interaction with them what he wanted to learn, and then he didn't want them anymore. So he had the accident and he closed down the prairie. And it was after this that he started to write. And somehow Ouspensky, when he heard about the accident, something's not right here. Something happened. And he wondered if Gurdjieff had somehow gone on the left-hand path, or, you know, he claimed to have been, his system came from what he called the Sarmung Brotherhood, you know, which was sort of like the Mahatmas for Madame Blavatsky in Tibet. This was a secret monastery that he encountered as a younger man in his travels in Central Asia. And his system, you know, came from that. But then it was sort of like, oh, it's his system now, not theirs. And it's kind of like, you know, he had gone rogue or something like that. And Ouspensky was a much more tactful, he was not the wild card that Gurdjieff was. You know, he was fairly bourgeois. Even though he was an artist and all that, but you know, all this kind of, and Gurdjieff was always acting all the time. He never knew, is this for real? Are you pulling my leg? And that was the whole idea. Teacher, is this a lesson? Well, I don't know. Is it? you tell me. And so Ouspensky, he was more a scientist. You do these exercises, you do this, you get those results. So in any case, he sort of think Gurdjieff went off the deep end. And then Gurdjieff later on, he produced this very strange work called Herald of Coming Good, which is the only one of his writings published at the time. I think it's still available. The Weiser published it years ago, but it had a faint sense of madness around it. It was just completely outrageous. And again, you don't know, is this for real? Is he pulling your leg? Is this a da da da, whatever? But he was making all these preposterous claims and having centers around the world and, you know, developing all this, you know, remarkable kind of technology and stuff, and nothing was going on whatsoever. And Ouspensky got one look at this and he said, oh my, you know, Gurdjieff's gone off the rails or something like that. So, but you never know, you know, you never know. So that was one of the things. There was a split there. And at that point, basically, Ouspensky says, you know, work with me, but you can't have anything to do with, you know, with Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff by that time had, you know, was, I don't know, doing many, many different, he was in the States for, you know, several years with Araj went to America to, you know, hit the drum, tub thumping for the Gurdjieff system, and in New York and in different places, and you know, basically drumming up as much money possibly as he could for him. And this was one of the things in the end that drove Araj away from Gurdjieff, is his incessant demands for money, and also the fact that Gurdjieff didn't like the woman that he married.
Well, all of this raises the question as to whether or not the Fourth Way was actually a system, or whether Gurdjieff was just experimenting the whole time.
Well, this is the question. What is the genuine, you know, Fourth Way? Nickel, in this fantastic monumental collection of what he calls the psychological commentaries on the teachings of Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, it's like a 5-6 volume set. He said in that, and in his own diaries and writings, he said his task is to hand on the teaching in the way that it was given to him without changing it in any way. You know, it has to be. And that's the teaching that Gurdjieff gave to Uspensky, and that's in the book In Search of the Miraculous. But then Gurdjieff later on says, "Oh no, I don't use those terms anymore. Self-remembering, what's that? I don't know. All that. No, I have a whole other stuff, and this is the stuff that came out of Beelzebub's tales. And so it's a whole other kind of thing. So someone who stayed in the Uspenskian line, let's say, and when they bumped into, you know, when they're both alive and they bumped into a Gurdjieffian, the Gurdjieffian would say, "Oh, you're still doing all that stuff? Well, this is the new thing and all that." But then Uspensky said, "Well, no, this is what Gurdjieff told me he learned from the Sarmung Brotherhood." Which is which? Is that the teaching? And so it was all, and again, I the impression I get, especially from the accounts from people at the Prairie, at the Institute, Moni's Development, Fontainebleau, was that everybody was on their toes constantly. Nobody knew exactly what was going on. Gurdjieff never said the same thing twice, many times, and Madame Blavatsky was like that as well. So is that the teaching itself, to keep you constantly sort of on your toes, you know? It's a story I tell in there about the Institute when, apparently hygiene wasn't, you know, top of the list. So there was like the kitchen was full of flies and all this kind of thing. And J.G. Bennett, who himself wrote many books about the work and was, an important thinker in his own right, started, Sherborne Institute here in London. Robert Fripp, the guitarist from King Crimson, was one of the famous people who went to school there and all that. But his partner, companion, Mrs. Beaumont, came to the Priory to visit. And she, you know, got one look at the kitchen. She got some fly paper and put it up. Suddenly the flies were gone. And so, but the others were saying, "Oh, no, we weren't supposed to do that. We had to deal with our negative emotions." But then Gurdjieff came in and said, "Ah, what a brilliant idea, the fly paper." And then walked down. So it's like, fly paper or no fly paper? You know, what is this? And then the other thing was like, was there really an institute? I mean, an exchange between Gurdjieff and Nickel, Gurdjieff is telling him, all of this is only temporary. You know, we don't build for posterity. You know, this will all be different. Everyone will be someplace else soon and all that kind of thing. So it's all temporary sort of thing. But at the same time, around the same time, he talks to J.G. Bennett and he tells him about his plans for building an observatory, you know, up in a certain point. And he's developed a way to make the planets look bigger through a certain special telescope. And all these other grandiose kinds of things. So was there really an institute? Was there no institute? Don't ask me. I don't know. Even Nickel, he tells the story. Someone is there saying to him, "Please, can you just tell me what's going on here, what we're doing?" He said, "Well, why are you asking me? I haven't the slightest idea. I don't know myself." So in some way, it's kind of like a live-in, live Zen, you know, koan, you know, to be in that place where you don't, and it's just up to you to decide, you know, what you do. And some people said, "Okay, I figured this out. This isn't for me." There's a fellow named James Young, who was one of the many people that were involved in the psychoanalysis early years, as you mentioned, in London. There was what they called the psychosynthesis group. It was, with the psychoanalysis, well, you take the psyche apart. Well, it's psychosynthesis. Let's put it back together. You know, sort of let's see if we can do a Humpty Dumpty on this. And, but he was there for a while. He was a student of Jung's. And then after a while, he just said, "No, I've just had it." And he went back. And Jung wrote him a letter congratulating him on his escape. Because, you know, I mean, one of the things I when I was writing this book, I said, "God, what would I give to have seen Jung and Gurdjieff in the same room together and see, like, what would?" Because in many ways, they're very similar. They're both larger-than-life characters. Mm-hmm. They both were good cooks. They both liked physical hard work. I mean, Jung, you know, famously built that tower and, you know, and did the stone chiseling and all that sort of thing. So I always wondered what would have happened had they met, you know.
Well, back to Maurice Nicole, you point out that one of his unique qualities is that he personally interacted with Gurdjieff, Uspensky, and Jung.
Yeah, you don't get too many people who had all three of them as teachers, but Yeah, when he, after he finished school at Cambridge, and what he was going to first do is be a, what they call a GP here, a general practitioner, you know, just a doctor. Then he heard about, you know, this new science, psychoanalysis and all that, and he became fascinated with that. And he basically asked his father, who was, you know, fairly well off, you know, can I go and study, you know, with Dr. Jung in Zurich and, you know, and all that. So he goes, and he doesn't meet Freud, but he certainly meets Jung. He actually encounters Jung during the time when Jung is going through the breakup with Freud. So he encounters Jung during the time when Jung is producing all this wild stuff that we know is the Red Book and going through his own psychotic breakdowns and having visions and waking dreams and all this sort of stuff. So Nicol meets him at a, you know, peculiarly, you know, special sorts of time. And all of this is in these diaries that Nicol kept around that time. And then later on, he stops the diaries when he starts becoming, when he starts going to the Prairie. But from the, like, I don't know, mid-19-teens up until, you know, then, he's keeping this diary and his dreams, interpretations of dreams, his encounters with Jung, and then later on his encounters with Uspensky and all that. So that's fascinating too, because these people are turning up in his dreams. So he's got Uspensky and Jung and all these other people in his dreams, and him trying to understand, well, these, according to Jung, these are projections of my own personality. So who's the Uspensky in me? Who's the Jung in me? And all that. So it's a remarkable kind of thing. And then also, I mean, you mentioned like the early years of psychoanalysis. Ernest Jones, who's, you know, Freud's bulldog, and writes the first big official biography. He's in there too, and he's kind of this shadow figure who, because what Jones wants to do, he's Freudian, you know, through and through, and he wants to get rid of all the Jungians. He wants to cut the Jungian rump off the psychoanalytic society, and Nicol is one of these people that he wants to get rid of. So it's all this, again, this kind of drama going on back there. It was incredible, rich time when all of these different ideas were sort of blending and flowing over each other, and before they all crystallized into, you know, different things.
If I understand correctly from your book, Gary, whereas the Jungians and the Freudians are deeply into dream analysis, and Nicol was following that pursuit, the fourth way teachers were saying dreams are meaningless, don't pay any attention to them at all.
Yeah, this is interesting. It's interesting. I mean, Nicol, the first books he wrote under his own name is called Dream Psychology, and it's kind of got lost, but it's the first book in English, if I'm correct, about Jung's psychology of dreams. And it's still a very important read. Uspensky wrote a lot about dreams, and he wrote a lot about hypnagogia, the in-between state between sleeping and waking. And there's a long chapter on those in his book, New Model of the Universe. But according to Gurdjieff, no, this is just, it's just a waste of time to write your dreams down, because you want to wake up. You know, you don't want to deal with all the stuff that when you're sleeping and all this kind of thing. And so, I mean, Gurdjieff said a lot of things. There's lots of stuff like, you know, breathing exercises are, you know, weren't good for you. And he called Kundalini Kundabuffer. So, you know, you half wonder, okay, is this a deep esoteric insight, or is he just basically, no, those guys don't know what they're doing. I know what they're doing. You know what I mean? Like, talking down the competition. I mean, it sounds crude, but you think, you know, you just wonder. Nicol continued to, well, he stopped the journals. He probably kept them going, but the only ones we have are these from these different times. Why exactly Gurdjieff says dreams? I don't know. I mean, Uspensky didn't have anything good to say about Freud or Jung or any of that sort of thing. I mean, one of the other things you discover, you read these people, none of them have anything good to say about each other. I mean, Jung had a client who was very much into anthroposophy and Rudolf Steiner, and she brought him some of Steiner's books, you know, to read. And then she asked him, what did you think? And he said, that man should be in an asylum. You know, so, you know, it's, you know, did he really mean that? It was tongue in cheek, you know, Swiss kind of, you know, humor. But it's true. I mean, Nicol wrote a very, very interesting book about dream from the Jungian point of view, which basically the difference between Freud and Jung's point of view, the simplest way is Freud is saying, where are dreams coming from? And Jung's saying, where are the dreams going to? So what's
How
the cause of the dream?
Yeah.
Freud is, what's the cause of the dream? Jung, what does the dream want? Right? So for Freud, there's, oh, you want to sleep with your mother or whatever, kill your father, and that's why you have this kind of dream. Or for Jung, it might be, oh, no, you really, you know, want to be a poet, or you really, you know, want to do something else, and that's why you had this dream. So the unconscious wants to become conscious. Again, that's the other difference, too. For Freud, the dream, and this on itself should prove Freudian notions about dreams incorrect. Freud said we have the dream so that we're not woken up at night. That the dream camouflages our real desires. That's why you need to go to the psychoanalysis to tell you what the dream means. So your unconscious is not letting you know what you really want, and so it covers it up with this camouflage so you have a good night's sleep, right? But most of us don't always have a good night's sleep for that reason. So it's a different kind of thing. Whereas Jung said, no, it's not camouflage at all. The dream is what it is. The dream is a natural product of the psyche. It's not trying to pull a fast one on you, but it speaks in the symbolic language. And that's what Nicole's book, Dream Psychology, is about. He basically, and again, it's not, this is pre-anima and pre-shadow Jung. This is before he starts using those sorts of terms. But it's what he calls the perspective tendencies of the unconscious. And if you're familiar with Jung's work, even that early on, you can see this is what will later become like synchronicity or something like that. You know, mm-hmm. the psyche's tendency to project itself out into the world. You know, it's goal oriented in a certain way. It's purposive. It's projecting out. It's the perspective tendencies. Whereas for Freud, it's like no. It's all the stuff back here that's making you, or even worse than Freud, just the purely materialistic ones. Oh, you had onions in your salad. You know what I mean? So that's the purely materialistic one. So
I'm under the impression, Gary, from your book, that the reason why Nicole's work is important is, I'd say two things. One, he very clearly lays out in a logical fashion the fourth way teachings. And two, he integrates them in a larger worldview that includes depth psychology, and it also includes the mystical teachings of people like Swedenborg and perhaps others in the Western esoteric tradition.
Yeah, that's one of the things I discovered some years ago before I even thought about doing this book was I was reading Nicole's psychological commentaries, and I've written a book about Jung. I've written a book about Swedenborg. And I think, oh God, that sounds like Jung. This sounds like the shadow, or this sounds like synchronicity or something like that. Love and wisdom. Well, those are real, key Swedenborgian terms. And so I discovered that actually, I knew that he had been, a follower of Jung, but then I later learned that in his last years, he became very, very interested in the work of Swedenborg. And one of the interests, again, is that Swedenborg himself, developed a kind of esoteric Christianity. Swedenborg devoted this huge text, Arcana Coelesta, the secrets of the heavens, to his esoteric interpretation of the book of Genesis. He was going to do the entire Bible, but I think, we should be thankful he stopped where he did, because, he would have had a book about 20 times as big as the Bible. But Nicol was doing the same sort of thing, and one of the things I say is, like, in his book, The New Man, which is his, rather thin but very, very important and dense work about his esoteric interpretations of the Gospels. And then there was another unfinished work called Mark. It's the same sort of thing. And they revolve around this notion of metanoia, which is the Greek term. And we say change of mind, but it's a much more powerful kind of experience than that. It's a complete transformation of your inner world. And so in some ways, I think Nicol's ideas of how to interpret dreams or how to read dreams fed into how he reads the parables. So parables, in a certain way, are similar to dreams because they communicate in a symbolic kind of language. And symbolic language means more than it says. A regular language says, and that's it. It says, it means what it says, and it's, I say what I mean, and I mean what I say. It's like symbolic language. Yeah, you can say something, but then what it means is something larger than just, you know, the literal meaning of the words. And this was the contrast, let's say, between the Presbyterianism that Mikkel grew up in, whereas the literal interpretation, like fundamentalist Christians today, you know, the Bible is the word of God, and it's the literal interpretation of it. Whereas, you know, no, that's what we would call the Petrine Church, the church that came out of Peter. You know, earlier time, there were, around the same time, before the Petrine Church became dominant, you had the Gnostics, the Gnostic Church, who were Christians at the time, but they had a more symbolic, esoteric interpretation of Christ's teachings and his acts and all that. And they were interested in what they called gnosis, which is a way of knowing something, the immediate, a kind of immediate intuitive way of knowing. And that's the kind of knowing that comes in dreams when you see, now I see what that means. It isn't like, oh yes, I put that together and that together. And I, you know, it isn't this logical sequence is kind of meaning. Suddenly it hits you like that. And this was the effect that Nicole said the parables had, you know, if you read them in this esoteric way, suddenly you could, you're not convinced by an argument, but you're lifted up into this, you know, more subtle and more penetrating way of seeing things. And this is something that, you know, Swedenborg did as well. So yes, he had this kind of melange. And as I said earlier, in most of the traditions of the fourth way that carry on from Gurdjieff, it's a purist kind of thing. You kind of stick to it, not necessarily in a kind of dry fundamentalist way, but it's a sort of sense where, you know, if you want to learn French, you don't start thinking in German, right? You know, it's sort of similar to that. But I think what Nicole, he was able to bring these things together. And himself personally, he was a much more congenial, friendly, almost jovial kind of, you know, proponent of a system that is often very, very austere and very demanding. I mean, Uspensky he became this kind of Iron Man logician, taskmaster sort of character. Gurdjieff, you never knew what was going to happen around him. You know, he would, you know, explode or whatever. But Nicole was kind of, you could sit at the pub with him and have a pint, as they say here. And he's kind of like a Chestertonian character, like the local vicar, like Father Brown or someone. And you could just, you know, sit with him and talk, and he would communicate in a kind of humorous sort of way, which doesn't necessarily come across in the writings, but the people who knew him around him, you say he was able to communicate deep, profound ideas in a humorous sort of way, and leave it to you to get it. And the same way, whether you get the joke or not, you know, there's certain jokes you have to be a bit intelligent to be able to see. Oh yeah, I get it. Right. So that would be the same kind of thing. And likewise with interpreting the dreams or interpreting the parables, it's a certain way of being able to see things that's a little bit above the everyday and the literal.
I'd like to go back to a topic we haven't really covered, which is the movements. I'm under the impression that if Gurdjieff did in fact learn anything at the Sarmung Monastery, it might very well have been those movements that he taught.
Well, he says in Meetings with Remarkable Men, which was It's Beelzebub's Tales was writing Meetings with Remarkable Men, and then there's a later book called Life is Real Only Then When I Am, which he left unfinished. But Meetings with Remarkable Men, it's about his early years in his travels with a group of others called the Seekers of Truth. And again, it's full of metaphor and symbolism. How much do you take literally? How much should be interpreted in terms of kind of, you know, a metaphor for something?
Was made into a wonderful movie by Peter Brook, as I recall.
Yes, exactly. Yes, and well, when I was in the work ages ago, one of the people who was the group leader was one of the principal dancers of the movements in that film. Mm. He passed away some years ago, but and if you know that scene in the film where they're doing the movements, it's suddenly it's like electric. And also when Terence Stamp comes on. He says there was this strange figure that this kind of statue that had moving arms. And it was something that, I forget the term he uses, but it was able to sort of, it would communicate, you know, the solar system or things of that sort. It would communicate astronomical kind of lore, but other things as well, and the different movements and, you know, positions and all that kind of thing. And it was from that, that the sort of different movements that, you know, he taught later on. And again, this was a later thing. It wasn't with the time with Uspensky. He didn't have that with Uspensky. So you wonder, okay, if you always had this, if you learned this in the Sawmung, why didn't you bring it up then? So did he learn it? Did he, you know, and that Meetings with Remarkable Men, the book didn't come out until the early 60s. So that was published, I think 61 or 62. So it was a later, addition to the work of literature. I practiced them a bit myself ages ago when I was in Los Angeles. And I have to say, I mean, they're very, very difficult. But one of the things I say in the book is, I think they're a way to purposely induce second wind. I'm not saying that's all they are, but I think physiologically we can understand in that way. And if you know second wind is when you're an athlete, you're running the marathon, whatever it is, and I just don't have any more, I can't do it anymore, I can't move another step. And then you push yourself, and then suddenly you got a full tank of gas and you're going 90 miles an hour and you just feel like, oh man, I could do this all night. So this is one of the things Nichols says in his diaries, that Gurdjieff's method is through induced frustration, where you're pushed beyond your limits. He had this idea of super efforts, where like a super effort, if you just walk 10 miles, walk another two before you rest. So you always do more than you have to. And so you purposely push yourself on. And I say this because this is what happened to me when I was trying to learn these movements. Again, this is ages ago. This would have been about 1983 or something like that, and in Los Angeles. And I learned some, and there's the piano music going on, and but there's a very difficult set of them, and I just couldn't get it. And I just can't do this. It's just about to drop out. And I tried one more time, and suddenly everything was where it should be. And I felt like, man, I just felt so full of energy. I wanted to get in my car and just drive to San Francisco, just for the fun of it. But the reason I say about the second wind is like the psychologist William James, who's, you know, a bit earlier, he met Freud. He was a bit earlier than Freud. He met Jung as well, but, you know, a bit earlier than them. But he wrote about this. He wrote a very important essay called The Energies of Men, where he talks about how we limit ourselves to sort of degrees of fatigue that we've only come by habit to obey. And if we're put into some kind of crisis situation where we're forced, you know, to do something, we suddenly discover we have all these energy. Or he would talk about neurasthenic patients with, oh no, I simply can't get out of bed. No, I can't do anything. I have no energy whatsoever. And he would apply what he called the bullying treatment, which I don't think you can get by today, but the bully, where he would force them to get out of bed, make an effort. Then suddenly it's child's play and they want to go, you know, run the marathon or whatever it is like that. So Gurdjieff, I believe, I'm not saying he didn't learn from wherever he learned, but I think the psychological, the physiological kind of, you know, explanation for it or mechanisms of it is that he pushed people beyond the limits that they had sort of voluntarily accepted is that this is it, this is all I can do. And then, no, you have much more. I mentioned Orage, the story of Orage, where he came, here's a guy who, you know, held his own with H.G. Wells and Bernard Shaw and other people at the time, and, you know, was very well known, very, very famous, prestigious, you know, editor in London. He's at the Prairie, he's given a shovel and he's told to dig. And you just dig until I come back and tell you not to dig. And then they fill up the hole. I'll dig it again and fill it up again. And he was doing this like, and he's like, he's backbreaking. He's even saying how he would cry himself to sleep at night and thinking, what the hell have I done? You know, what the hell have I put myself into here? And then the next day he goes and he digs and suddenly he's enjoying the digging. And he's doing it. He's like digging more than he did, and he just doesn't want to stop digging, you know. And a couple of years ago, I started painting my flat, and I so enjoy doing it. I put myself into it that I wanted to go paint my neighbor's flat. I want to knock on their door and say, "Do you need any touch up or anything like that?" So it's the whole. If you somehow put more, this is something that Colin Wilson, who I've written about, he has this notion of the robot, but just a simple thing. If you put more into some everyday activity, some habitual activity than you're used to putting into, more than it actually needs, you can actually find yourself enjoying doing it.
Well, it seems as if that idea of the second wind is also a good argument for why we need coaches, teachers, and gurus, why it's better not to try to do it all on your own.
Well, yeah, unless you're a self-motivator, then yeah, I guess the idea is to get you going. I mean, Nicol was someone who he admitted when he wrote his letter to Jung saying that, I've come across this other teaching, and I think I can get more out of it than what I'm getting from your work, important as it is. But he admitted that, you know, Jung left too much up to him. It was like, here's the materials that you can work with, but you have to do it yourself. And Nicol himself just admitted he needed someone to force him. Throughout his diaries, he laments his laziness and at times and things like that. So there's a kind of inertia, an inner resistance. That we all have it. We're all faced with that. You know, he talks about. But he says to Jung, one of the things I need somebody to sort of force me. You know, and that's exactly what he got. But I guess the other side of that is at a certain point, it's like, well, if the whole idea is for you to get on your own 2 feet, at what point do you decide, no sensei, I'm going to go off and, you know, on my own now or whatever, you know? I guess one of the questions is, do you ever graduate from the Gurdjieff school, the Gurdjieff work? Do you ever graduate and go, okay, I've learned what I can? I mean, after Uspensky died in 47, a lot of his students wound up going to Gurdjieff, and he was in Paris at that time. But Nicol didn't go, and he was one of the few people who didn't go and see Gurdjieff after Uspensky's death. And he basically said, well, I learned what I could from him. And any true believer at the time would say, no, you can always learn something more. You know, but he didn't go. And I think that's another reason why he's been kind of sidelined, you know, in the sort of Gurdjieff world tradition. He's there, but he's not one of the sort of main sort of figures who gets mentioned, you know, when you talk about the ones who are, you know, carrying on the work.
The subtitle of your book is The Forgotten Teacher of the Fourth Way. And I gather you're arguing that it would be better if he wasn't so forgotten.
No one else that I know of had Jung, Uspensky, and Gurdjieff, all his teachers, knew them personally, had, you know, personal encounters with them and all that. And then was able to blend all these things together later with the helpings of Swedenborg. Plus other things is too. I mean, if you're reading the diaries and then also reading his own writings, he's reading books about Zen. He's reading books about, Indian philosophy, Buddhism and all that kind of, so he's always kind of, you know, keeping, and I said, and along with Swedenborg, he became very interested in Meister Eckhart. And it's a different kind of, it isn't the kind of strenuous path that the Gurdjieff work is, like you're striving all the time, working against your, you know, mechanicalness. This is more of a kind of letting go, I guess let go and let God is kind of the catchphrase of it. But it's a different sort of thing. And he even says that, you know, in his diaries. He says, well, this isn't the same sort of path, but then I feel more attuned toward this. I think it's the Christian sort of thing. I mean, he grew up in Presbyterianism, it was very dour, you know, depressing kind of, you know, faith, but he always had a great love of Jesus and a great love of God, and he basically wanted to find some kind of congregation that he felt he could belong to. He didn't feel he belonged to the congregation that he was growing up in. Early on, that meant there must be something wrong with me. Just later on, he figured, no, there's something wrong with it. So I think that's the other thing too, is that the kind of no, there's like, you know, be perfect as your father is perfect. There's that side of Jesus. That doesn't get as much press as, you know, come to me, all the weary and, you know, laden and all that kind of thing. So it's more of giving over your burden, you know, to a greater power. And again, you have to recognize that he was ill in his last years too. So, physically he was feeling Not as strong as he had been when he was doing all the more strenuous kind of work.
He died of cancer, as I recall.
Yes, yeah. And he somehow knew in advance, quite a few years in advance, that he had this intuition that it was his last years were coming. And this is one of the things that led to making sure that the commentaries were published before he died, and also making sure that, they said, the short book, The New Man, was published. I mean, sadly, I mentioned this kind of laziness and inertia with Nicole. This is one of the things. He found it difficult to finish writing, which is, it's one of the paradoxes I found. Like, well, you did all this other stuff, but then he wrote this sort of best-selling books. He also, earlier, he was a contributor to the magazine The Strand, which was a famous magazine in London. The Sherlock Holmes stories were written, all that kind of thing. So he was well-known at a certain point, and, you know, he could meet a deadline, you know. But then somehow later on, it became very, very difficult for him to sit down and actually sit down and write and finish the thing. And he was always kind of starting and stopping, and then there's a lot of, you know, self-recrimination in the diaries about that. And he would go and do something else. He'd like to do hands-on stuff. He was very, like Gurdjieff, he was very mechanical. He was very good at, you know, DIY and Mr. Fix-It and stuff like that. So I think he preferred doing that to the actual writing. But once he intuited that his days were numbered, as it were, you know, he labored to get, you know, finished what he could to pass on to his legacy. And he's got some, you know, interesting readers. I mean, E.F. Schumacher, you know, the economist, you know, Small is Beautiful, he was one of his readers. Jakob Needleman, the American philosopher, who's also was involved in the Gurdjieff work and was also interested in traditionalism, things like that. But John Cleese, you know, the Monty Python comedian, he said in a couple of interviews that the psychological commentaries are one of his favorite books. And he said more than once that Nicol was one of the most important sort of thinkers of, you know, spiritual ideas that he's ever come across. So, yeah, he's had some interesting readers over the years.
And I gather that at the time of his death, he had many students, hundreds of students, and was greatly beloved by them. But at the same time, you hint that some of the early psychological problems that he may have developed, conflicts with his parents, for example, the repression of his upbringing in the Christian church, these are things that he may never have resolved in spite of all of his other attainments.
Well, I mean, he's not alone. We all carry, you know, we carry the eggshells of our birth around with us, as Hermann Hesse says in the beginning of one of his books. But no, he died in 1953, and he had about 800 students that would come out to one of the places he had outside of London. Everyone who met him said he was one of the most remarkable people they've ever met, and he was unlike anyone else. So he must have had a kind of immediate presence. And, you know, you would think he was a doctor, you know, so he must have had a good, you know, bedside manner. You know, he was a psychologist, so he knew how to be empathic with people and all that. As I said, throughout the diary, there's, and again, the diary itself is a 1,000-plus page, you know, monster, where it's all fragmentary, and he writes in a code, and he's relating his dreams, interpreting the dreams, talking about meaning of the dreams at the same time. So it takes a lot of work to kind of get some idea of what he's talking about. And there's a lot about sex. I mean, it doesn't come through in his work, in the writings, but he himself says that in many ways he had an obsession with sex, and he pursued a kind of mystical kind of erato mystical kind of almost tantric kind of practice that I think a few times, you know, going by what he recorded in the diary, it sounds like he did reach some sort of illuminated states in them, some sort of altered states of consciousness in them. But yes, as you say, you know, he was this conflict. Later on in life, he felt really bad about leaving Jung, and he wrote Jung a kind of letter, you know, apologizing for this kind of thing. And Jung always had difficult time with the relationships with men. He had much better relationships with the women than he was with men. And I think he always felt a little awkward when anyone was trying expressing kind of love or anything like that. And then he also, Nicol felt that he had somehow slandered Uspensky in some way. So it was a lot of self-recrimination, a lot of, feeling bad, simply about himself at different times. And again, if you know his background, his father's not known today, William Robertson Nicol, but at the time, he was very, very important political and religious writer. And he's one of these alpha males. You know, that was just everything around him. He's cigarettes all the time. He's got secretaries all the time around him. He's living up in, not far from where I live in London, Hampstead, really nice, part of town, up in the hills and green and leafy and all that. And he doesn't have much time for little Morris, who's essentially, he had a sort of scientific kind of mechanical bent. And his father wasn't interested in that at all. And so he did, so there's a feeling like he always kind of had the shadow of a very, dominating, famous father around him. And again, he wrote under a pseudonym, the fiction he wrote. He wrote a fantastic science fiction novel called The Blue Germ. No one knows about it, but and when I was writing the book, it was like during the height of COVID, and I thought this someone should found this book and put it out, because it's a germ that, rather than make you sick, it makes you it kills all the other germs. So it's a germ that kills all the other germs, and it grants you immortality. And so it's the theme of like, well, what do we do with the immortality? And so it's different expressions of, this person does that person does this kind of thing like that. But it's actually, it's well written. And it's actually, an enterprising publisher might do well putting it out. Mm-hmm. So, but that was written under this pseudonym. So he kind of had this alter ego where he was living out this larger life, but as himself in a certain way. He always, was sort of, I always got the feeling he's kind of like, not cringing, but there's always this sense of this big kind of father over him. And he stuttered. He had this bad stutter, and through sessions with Jung cured him of the stutter. And the stutter was rooted in this sense of somehow intimidation with his father.
Well, Gary, we could go on and on. There's a great deal. I have to highly recommend your book to our audience. I know one of your reviewers said it's your best book ever, and I know you've written many, many books at this point, and I do have to say, I think your skill as a historian and as a writer, it just keeps getting better with each book. So this one, for anyone who has any curiosity about the early 20th century, about the birth of depth psychology, and certainly about the fourth way, would want to read this book very much. I highly recommend it. So once again, Gary, thank you for being with me.
Oh, it's absolutely a pleasure, Jeffrey. Thank you very much.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.